Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So we've got, this is our the beginning of our last month of our Vassa retreat, about just over 4 weeks to go. And the mind is becoming more empty, waiting for the words to come. So I've reflected previously about recollecting this blessed opportunity, really, to continue on with a retreat. Retreat practice after 2 months and moving into our third month, and with the spring energy, as I've mentioned previously, it's easy to get affected by that, the kind of upsurging of the energy in the natural world and in one's own mind. And it's different to the winter energy, where you can hunker down and focus inwardly a little more easily. The spring energy, I don't know if others are affected in similar ways, but the spring energy is an uprising one, that you tend to start looking out. You get a few more flowers budding, and the creatures are coming out more. The sun's getting higher in the sky, the days are getting longer, the light element is increasing. And so this can be just as good for practice, less cold outside, can do more walking meditation, but it's also more easy for the mind to get engaged with things happening out there. Just for me, watching my own eyes engaging when there's more light, looking at the flowers, the creatures. This isn't bad in itself, but what it can do is it can tend to just lead to losing a focus on just watching the mind, which is what we've been cultivating in a meditation retreat. There's certainly times for reflecting, or opportunity, I should say, for reflecting on the experience in the world around us and as we interact, but just to be aware of the effect, if you like, the effect of, it can begin with the eyes or the energy or the mind beginning to move out, and just noticing what happens there. Does it tend to lead to a losing of an energy once gathered internally, or maybe not, maybe it helps one reflect on the objective world and how one gets engaged. This is also an important aspect of experience, to reflect upon this subject-object dualism that we get. I was going to say fooled by, but I guess we're in it most of the time, that we don't know we're fooled by it. But a full belief that I am the subject, I am within this frame of this body, and the objective world is out there, happening around me. I am this and that is out there. This needs to be really inquired into. So it may be an opportune time to talk a little bit about that, if the eyes or the energy or the energy of doing or activity is moving one out. Because the Buddha gave some key teachings on reflecting on this sense of subject-object, on the seen, the heard, the smelt, the tasted, the touched, the cognized. We very much believe that we are the agents, we are the doer, we are the knowers. And through this vehicle, we know the world out there. But the Buddha quite regularly sets out in the teachings in the suttas and encourages practitioners to really examine where the world actually arises. We really project an out there, whereas actually, if we inquire into the nature of our experience of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, cognizing, or thinking, where does it happen? It's perceived and conceived by the mind. Without this mind, there is no experience of the world. The Buddha actually called the world this very field of sense spheres. He said, this is what I call the world, the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body and mind. Because we know the world through those sense doors. We experience the world through those sense doors. And the five senses have their resort in the mind. The mind, without the mind, there is no perceiving or cognizing of that experience. So this is worth reflecting on deeply. And as with all the Buddha's teachings, not just to be satisfied with, playing with it intellectually, but take it deeply into your practice, into your everyday experience, into your everyday contemplation. When you are seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking, knowing, where is that happening? Where is that experience arising? And what happens when it does arise? This is where the subject-object duality, the experience of a subject in here and object out there, is created in that moment. So it's not surprising that the Buddha gave a lot of emphasis to the six sense fields or spheres to be contemplated. And there's some quite well-known teachings to Bahia and Malunkyaputta, I believe. Malunkyaputta was an older wandering spiritual seeker, I think, and he came to the Buddha asking for a teaching, which was the same that was given, or similar that was given to Bahia, the bark cloth. To train oneself thus in the seen, let there be only the seen. In the heard, let there be only the heard. In the sensed, which is the smelt, the tasted and the touched, let there be only the sensed. And in the cognized, let there be only the cognized. For when you train yourself like this, and for you, there is just the seen, the heard, the sensed, and the cognized when these things are happening. You will find that you are not here, nor there, nor anywhere in between. And this, just this, is the end of suffering. So it's a bit of an obscure way of talking about how this subject-object sense of self and location, sense of self and location in relation to sense experience, arises. What happens for us usually with the seen, the heard, the sensed, the cognized? It's not, we don't usually just know the seen in the seen, or the heard in the heard, the sensed in the sensed, or the cognized in the cognized. We usually don't just know it as that. What happens is that becomes a trigger for this sense of I arising, and the meaning making out of this, and then the proliferating, the I and the object, and the proliferating thinking about what this all means to me and what I'm going to do with it or how I'm going to be with this. It stimulates desire, it stimulates craving and clinging right at these sense doors, at these sense experiences. And first, actually, it stimulates feeling tone of pleasure or pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, which is the basis for craving and clinging to arise. So these are key aspects of the dependent origination teaching, Paticca Samuppada. So if you're feeling inclined towards this kind of contemplation, with the spring energy emerging, it's a good time to do it while we're still in retreat, because it is a fine contemplation. You can engage this even in your walking meditation, in the seen. Let there be only the seen. What's that about? Explore that, look into that. And if there's not just the seen, what's happening there? Bring your awareness to just what's happening there. How does the self, the sense of self, get born in that moment of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, cognizing? To think about it, again, it might sound a bit obscure or even overwhelming. How can I be with every moment of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, or cognizing? So the Buddha's not asking us to do something we can't do, but just to take one little bit of that contemplation at a time. And it's worth breaking it down to something we can really get our handle on. He talks about these sense experiences as, he first talks about the sense base, as in the eye, the functioning eye, and the visual object. If you don't have a functioning eye, there's no seeing, right? So it's, the seeing is dependent on a functioning organ of sight. Or similarly, if the eye is functioning but no visual object comes within its range, then eye consciousness doesn't arise. But when there is a viable sense organ, a visual object comes into the range of the eye, and eye consciousness arises dependent on the two. If one is paying attention to that object, of course, eye consciousness arises right there. And he says the meeting of the three is sense contact. Sense contact gives rise to feeling. Feeling gives rise to craving. Craving gives rise to clinging. Or is the basis, is the supportive condition for the arising of these things. So for us to bring our awareness to this process can be really helpful to slow down what's happening there and actually inquire into these very important dhammas that the Buddha's pointing to. Sense contact, visual consciousness, as in sense consciousness, vijnana, sense contact giving being the basis for feeling tone to arise, feeling tone being the basis for wanting, the wanting or the not wanting to arise in relation to that feeling tone. These are very subtle, discrete activities, events in the mind that occur. So subtle and discrete, we don't usually notice them, we just move along in the flow, and whatever the habit patterns are in terms of what we make, what we've learned, what we make of this experience, and then we kind of pack it into the duffel bag of self and identity, and it becomes part of who we are, whether we like this experience or don't like this experience. But there's a lot of assumptions taking place there. So with our mindfulness, with our awareness that we're developing and strengthening through meditation, through samadhi, strengthening if you like, through samadhi, we're encouraged to use the strength of that mind to contemplate, to develop wisdom, to contemplate this sense experience, to contemplate the body, to contemplate the sense of self when it arises, to contemplate craving if it's triggered. This is the purpose of meditation, not just to become still and get stuck in that stillness and enjoy the stillness. The purpose is to see clearly, to develop punya. Now, sometimes just due to the mind being more still, sometimes we naturally see more clearly, but sometimes the mind can get stuck to that stillness, so we don't want to know anything. So, and some characters are different. Some people incline more to just wanting to stay in their stillness, and so for them they have to actually put in more effort to contemplate. Ajahn Mahabua was one of these types of people, so he recounts stories of his own very, very strong and powerful efforts in samadhi, and he attained very deep samadhi, but he was kind of stuck on it, and Ajahn Mun had to really help him to contemplate. And there's other characters who are more thinkers and more desiring to know, and it's harder for them to become still. But when they do become still, the wisdom mind will usually leap up quite quickly to see things clearly. So, you know, we ultimately, it's good to know our character and our tendencies so we can develop things, meditation and aspects of meditation accordingly and appropriately. But to develop punya, to develop wisdom, to see how this sense of I, this sense of self gets created, and at that very same place is where the sense of the dualistic experience of self and other, or self and world, gets created. With the teaching to Mulunkiaputta, the Buddha, he's an older man, and the Buddha says to him, you know, is there really in your age condition, is there really anything that you yet haven't seen and you still want to see, that you haven't yet heard and you still want to hear, that you haven't smelt and still want to smell or taste or touch or think about or know? Is there really anything left? And he says, no, there's nothing left I really want to see or hear or smell or taste or touch or know. Those of you who aren't in your 50s or 60s yet, you might not recognize that feeling of being a bit over it. I've seen, heard, smelt, taste, touched, and known enough, you know, I just want to be done with it now. So he started this way with Mulunkiput, and he said, well, if there's nothing, you know, then use this practice. Whatever there is that's seen, just let there be only that, just the seen. If there's hearing, just let it be the heard. The sense, just the sensed. The cognized, just that, just the cognized. And he went off and practiced this way, and as the suttas say, in not a very long time he attained full awakening. With just that encouragement, you know, to turn your attention a particular way and to not seek more than what is, to not seek more than what is just apparent. And in the not seeking, one's mind opens, one's mind abandons craving. And in that space, the deathless reality can be known with the abandoning of craving. In the no longer needing to seek. You know, for Mulunkiputta, that he was old, maybe why couldn't he figure that out for himself? But no, he just needed that little reminder, well, there's no need to seek anything more in these sense experiences. If you've seen, smelt, heard, tasted, touched, known enough, then as this experience continues to arise, wherever you are, just let it be that. Don't seek any more from it. And that was enough to help him really chill, or really perhaps just tweak his practice a little bit to allow that habitual seeking energy that just keeps emerging, that wants to taste a bit more, see a bit more, do a bit more. For me, I've been noticing in this retreat, just that which wants to know. You know, there's the doer, the strength of the doer and the knower, as Ajahn Brahm often points out. And for me, it's not so much the doer that fools me. It's that which wants to know, because it easily disguises itself as wisdom, or that if I just know this, you know, I've got that really questioning mind. But after a while, it can question anything, you know, forever. You can still see samsara going on there, just wanting to know this, wanting to know that. And it's like, when is enough enough? This is just a question I, you know, ask myself lately. Because it's the habitual seeking to know, there's some kind of desire driving that. If I get the right thing, then it should be all right. Things should resolve. If I just can understand this, then that will somehow make it better. So really looking into just that movement, because it literally moves the mind out as well. So just backing up for myself, just learning, exploring how to back off on that. Just entertain this possibility of not needing to know anything anymore. How peaceful would that be? Not needing to know. It throws the mind back into the moment. Often just resting in a sense of peace and not needing to know. Yet the mind is bright. There's wisdom there. Wisdom doesn't need to think necessarily, or even to cognize necessarily, when there's that full presence, that full knowing. So this is what we practice in meditation, isn't it? When we sit with the mind in all of its movement, we get to know how it moves in its habitual movements, where it moves to, and the more subtle movements as the grosser hindrances can settle down, the more subtle movements is the mind that wants to know, rather than staying in the knowing. It wants to know out there, it wants to know something, wants to go out and get something and bring it back. There's still a seeking in that. So if we can wake up to that and know that as a kind of agitation in and of itself, we turn the mind back on the mind, awareness back on just knowing that, and something can be released. Now this isn't to inhibit curiosity or the natural seeing of panya, of wisdom. So it's really just to get to know this movement, this desire of wanting. So at any of the sense doors, the seeing, do I want to see something different? Do I want to smell something different or something more? Taste, that's an easy one, because we get hungry, we often want to taste things that agree with us. Touching, we don't often contemplate that much, but just the movement, you know, if your body's uncomfortable in any posture throughout the day or in meditation, you can just see the vibhava tanha, the moving away from an uncomfortable sensation. We can contemplate there this desire for a more comfortable sensation, or the not wanting the discomfort. So this isn't to inhibit your capacity to wisely know when you need to change postures, but it's just in order to bring some more clarity and awareness and contemplation to those moments of wanting, of sense contact, of feeling tone, of wanting or not wanting, and the sense of self that's born there in that desire. This is the territory of wisdom. And if we can bring a degree of samadhi or stillness of mind to that, we can often see things we haven't seen before, understand aspects of that, the relationship of those things that we haven't understood before. But if this isn't pointed out to us as a fruitful place to look, we might not necessarily turn our attention there. So that's the whole, the reason the Buddha teaches as he does, to point out these aspects of experience which have good potential, great potential for awakening. And perhaps it's classic, but perhaps the most important of these things that he points out are those classic teachings about anicca, dukkha, anatta, the impermanent, transient, unstable nature of everything we experience. So when we turn to investigate the seen, or the heard, or the sensed, or the cognized, we notice the instability of that, the impermanence of that, the transience of that. The seeing, the hearing, the smelling, the tasting, the touching, the knowing is momentary. If our awareness is strong enough to really see that as a sense contact which comes and goes in the moment, Something profound can be known and seen there. But if we hadn't been made aware to recognize impermanence, to recognize these moments of sense contact, we might not otherwise look. So not to overlay an idea, to paste an idea onto our experience, but to be so present with your experience with a mind that's already primed with an understanding of impermanence, of anicca, with an understanding of dukkha, dukkha arising with craving. As soon as there's craving and clinging, there's dukkha. We know that experience. We can be sensitive to that. But dukkha, craving, clinging are also momentary experiences. And these can be seen and discerned with wisdom. Wisdom, the mind, the knowing mind, can discern these truths and they can have a profound impact on our way of seeing. They can change our view to right view, to samadhi. So when we see something in our own experience as anicca, it usually deepens our understanding of dukkha and also reveals anatta. If something is impermanent, how can there be a permanent essence of self within that? If the mind discerns an experience to be now here, now gone, where is the self in that? A self cannot be discerned in something that has disappeared. There's no existing, abiding entity there. This can be seen. And again, the talking about it is, it can almost make these experiences or truths sound quite mundane. The intellect, the conceiving mind, can pick them up and play with them, if you like. But the Buddha's teachings are intended as practice instructions. So it's very important for these to be effective, to have any use at all, to take these instructions into your practice, into your contemplation, because it's only in those places that they will bear fruit and clarify the view. We can easily get wrong view when we just play with them intellectually. They're no longer liberating teachings. So all of the Buddha's teachings are like this. And it's up to us to, I guess, keep goading ourselves to use these teachings to wake up, not just to have, you know, a kind of a philosophy or a way of life that we agree with and feel comfortable with and that serves us for whatever means. Even though this in itself isn't bad, but the whole intention of the teachings is for waking up. So we need to keep remembering to use them like that, to bring them in. And at different times in our practice and our life, different teachings will speak to us. So it's not as if you have to take one thing and hammer it out for the rest of your life. Be sensitive to what speaks to you. And explore that, because your natural interest, your wisdom mind is pricking its ears there, because there's something there for you. So that's worth exploring, and then you have that natural energy and inquiry to lead you into that. And the Buddha's teachings were We've got a great collection of them now, everything that he taught over 45 years to so many people. But it's worth remembering that each of those teachings were very situational, very dependent on the person or the people that he was speaking to, very tuned to that person's or those people's awakening. So there is some relative aspect to the delivery of these particular teachings. So, you know, there may be certain teachings that we read that don't speak to us at all. So it's okay not to be concerned about those. You know, it's not as if you're, it doesn't have to create a problem with your faith. But those teachings that you resonate with, pick them up and work them. Because there's something in your heart that's speaking to you about that. So maybe there's something in what I've said tonight that's been helpful, or maybe not. So along the same lines, if it's helpful, pick it up and work it. If it's not, then just leave it right here. Okay.